Thank you for coming to the afternoon session on science and education and faith. We have three speakers this afternoon, two Michaels and one Stephen. So we're going to start off with Stephen Dillick.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, as you can tell from both screens, I have some ideas for fortifying biological education. I have to give a special nod to he's really more of a co-author, a graduate student at St. Ed's, Nick Tafakari, and if you find anything in the presentation you don't like, it's his fault, right? You should keep that in mind.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, that's right, yeah. A couple of contentions that I want to argue. First, a number of biology textbooks endorse problematic theology-laden arguments for evolution. And when I use the term evolution, I mean neo-Darwinism in this talk. Two, when professors and teachers present arguments for evolutionary theory, they might consider avoiding these arguments. And then three, I'll suggest that instead they might consider exposing students to different arguments for evolution. A few qualifications before we continue. First, I will critique select arguments for evolutionary theory. I'll focus on a particular class of arguments, certainly not the whole range of arguments. And I want to point out that my critique does not imply that evolutionary theory itself is false, nor does it imply that all arguments for evolutionary theory fail. I'm looking at a particular class of arguments rather than all of them. Nick and I have studied about 30 textbooks, both biology textbooks and evolution textbooks, abroad, everything from middle school textbooks to advanced undergraduate textbooks. The pattern we think we've noticed here remains to be seen how pervasive it is in other textbooks, but we can at least speak about the ones we've looked at. And I'll give four examples. Nick and I are writing a paper. It has more. Right now we just have four. I want to note first, before we get into the weeds, that all the arguments that I'll look at that follow have the same basic structure. They're not this explicit, but this is the architecture, as it were, the basic template. Premise one, if evolutionary theory is true, we'd expect X, some data. Premise two, if God or a designer created directly, then we would not expect X. We would not expect the data. Premise three, we've actually found X. Premise four, if the evidence is expected on one hypothesis but unexpected on another, then the evidence strongly supports the former over the latter. Thus, the data strongly support evolutionary theory over creationism or ID. So as I said, all the arguments that follow this format. They're not as explicit as this in the textbook, but that's the kind of the template, as it were, that they use. Nick and I look specifically at sections in textbooks marked the evidence for evolution, right? So that's where we focused. And the arguments we look at are all positive arguments for evolutionary theory, not just critiques of rivals, but positive arguments. You'll notice premise two, in each case, with one exception, which I'll get to, in each case, the theology-laden claim is not entailed by creationism, I'll focus on young earth creationism, or on ID, or made probable by those views, right? So we'll look at some theology-laden premises, but that are, in a way, foreign to young earth creationism and ID. It looks like instead the authors, the textbook authors, bring their own theology to the table in the way that they fill in, as it were, premise two. Okay, on to the first example here, which Nick and I call irrelevant theology. Irrelevant because, in our view, it relies upon an egregious straw man of contemporary creationism, the young earth view, or of ID as part of a positive case for evolutionary theory. So here's an example. Advocates of the view that all organisms were created simultaneously by God argue that there are no vestigial organs because if any function at all can be attributed to a structure, it cannot be considered functionless, even if its removal has no effect. Thus, according to this view, ostrich wings are not evidence of evolution because they can be used to brush off biting insects. Is this a valid argument? So as the authors nod here, they've already established earlier that on an evolutionary view, vestigial organs are expected. Here they're giving, in the form of a rhetorical question, the other half of the argument, right? So they're giving, here's the data, vestigial organs, it's not expected. on a creationist view, but it is expected on an evolutionary view, so it supports evolutionary theory over its rival. Now, there's an interesting seed of an argument here, but notice how the rival is portrayed. Creationism is portrayed as holding that all organisms were created simultaneously by God. Not all kinds or all species, all organisms, which apparently means the creationists think that God directly, individually, created each bacterium, right, or each golden retriever in last year's litter, or something like that. In addition, creationists apparently think all organisms were created simultaneously by God. So that would mean the authors are attributing to their creationist rivals really the view that you are the same age, right, as your parents and grandparents. You're all created simultaneously. So the textbook authors give no citation, no references that any creationists actually believe this. They don't give any data supporting their contention that this is the creationist view. It's just a portrayal. Interestingly enough, as a footnote, it's not just contemporary young earth creationism that's misrepresented, but even 19th century special creationism is often misrepresented. It's portrayed as a young earth view, which is not the case. So that's the first example. Let's look at another example. What we call overconfident theology. Overconfident because, in our view, of its excessive certitude without any justification given about what God would do. So, a number of examples. Here's one from biological science. An engineer would never use the same underlying structure to design a grasping tool, a digging implement, a walking device, a propeller, and a wing. Instead, the structural homology exists because mammals evolved from the lungfish-like ancestor, which had the same general arrangement of bones in its fins. Notice, once again, it's a comparative argument. Evolutionary theory expects X, right? Its rival expects not X. We go and find X, right? So the data, as it were, of morphological and genetic similarity support evolution over its rival. But notice, once again, how the rival is portrayed. An engineer would never use the same underlying structure, right? So, of course, in this context, and if you read the broader chapter, it's clear that the relevant engineer in mind would be some kind of divine being capable of creating species, right? So the assumption in the argument here is that God would never borrow from a previous design, modifying it into different structures and functions for new species, right? God doesn't borrow, evidently. Naturally enough, since this is a crucial part in a comparative argument, right? Remember premise two, right? Without that premise two, the argument is logically invalid. You would think there would be some citation, some evidence, some argument, some justification from a religious source, from a non-religious source, from any source at all. But of course, there is none. It's just an assertion. Moreover, this claim is not entailed, and as far as I can find, it's not even made probable by young earth creationism, or by ID, right? It's foreign to those views, compatible with them, but certainly not entailed by them. It appears that the authors just insert their own preferred theology as a way to characterize their opponents, makes it much easier to knock down and to support evolutionary theory. Okay, here's another example, what we call indeterminate theology. Indeterminate because, as we see it, theology is too vague or generalized to be useful for the pro-evolution argument at hand. Here's an example. Four decades ago, the French geneticist François Jacob made the analogy that evolution works like a tinker, assembling new structures by combining and modifying the available materials, and not like an engineer who is free to develop dramatically different designs, a jet engine to replace a prop-driven engine, for example. We have seen that morphological evolution is not usually governed by the acquisition of radically new genes, but proceeds primarily by tinkering with expression patterns of existing genes. So it's a comparative argument, right? With an engineer on the one hand, as it were, and evolutionary processes on the other hand. We look at the data, we look at what each predict. Evolution's prediction is vindicated, the other one isn't. So it's a positive argument for evolutionary theory, but notice how the engineer is characterized. The engineer who is free to develop dramatically different designs, a crucial premise in the argument, premise two, once again. So the question here is, how should we understand this claim that an engineer is free to do something? As far as I can tell, if a divine engineer, right, or any engineer, right, clearly divine is one possibility in the context, if a divine engineer is free to do X, then in the past he could have done X, right? Being free to do something means you have the ability to do it, right? You have the capacity to do it. So it's possible that God would do so. Perhaps he did X. Being free to do X, though, does not mean God would have done so, right? So an omniscient being, an omnipotent being, is free to do anything short of make a logical contradiction true, right? Free to do anything at all, make only hydrogen atoms, right? Annihilate Congress. Nope, that didn't happen, right? Just because God is free to do something doesn't mean he would, doesn't give us any reason to think it's probable at all. So recall the original argument here by Sadova et al., namely that on evolution we would expect morphological and genetic similarities, right? And it looks like their premise two is really something like this. If a divine engineer created each species, then it's possible each one would be genetically and morphologically different from all other species rather than having genetic and morphological similarities with one or more species. Interestingly enough, this claim is entailed, it's the one exception, it is entailed by young earth creationism. Because you have a God, a three-o God, an omnipotent God, then of course it's possible, right? Certainly logically possible God would act that way, but certainly not entailed by the view. All right, so here's the problem with indeterminate theology. Premise one is something like evolutionary theory predicts X rather than Y. Premise two, a divine engineer is compatible with Y, that is, it's possible God would do Y. But of course, compatibility with Y does not entail or make probable that God would do Y instead of X. Indeed, compatibility with Y is fully consonant with God doing X every time. It's possible for God to turn baby white-tailed deer, the moment they're born, into hippos, right? It's possible. It turns out he doesn't do that, right? So what does all this mean? In my view, the bottom line is to make their argument successful, these authors need to show that genetic and morphological similarities between newer and older species are more expected given evolutionary theory than given a divine engineer, but they haven't done so. Now, there may be other arguments that are better than this, but this particular argument, hinging on the claim that God is free, many examples of this, doesn't do it. All right, last example, what we call atheodicy theology. Atheodicy because it attacks God's justice, so to speak, as part of a positive argument for evolutionary theory. Yet, at least as far as we can tell, does so by relying on questionable theology-laden assumptions. So one text, Douglas Fatuma's most recent edition of Evolution, which is regarded by many as the top evolution textbook in the English-speaking world, right? Top of the food chain here. He gives a whole litany of cases of what he views as natural pain and suffering in the biological world, right? Says these are incompatible with a beneficent designer. And then sort of rounds out the argument by saying, nor can we rationalize why a beneficent designer would shape the many selfish behaviors that natural selection explains, such as cannibalism, siblicide, and infanticide. So again, we have a comparative argument. Natural selection can explain certain behaviors, but these behaviors can't be explained, right? They're anomalous on a beneficent designer view, right? So the data support evolutionary theory over the view of the hypothesis of a beneficent designer. Again, a positive argument. It's really a version of the what philosophers call natural problem of evil, right? Okay, but you notice he says humans can't rationalize. I take it that means something like if we can't rationalize an answer, a reason, then we cannot think of any morally sufficient reason why God would cause or allow certain types of natural pain and suffering, such as these selfish behaviors. It follows that all the answers, all the reasons given from the ancient past to the present day are manifestly incorrect, right? It just follows as a matter of course from Fatuma's assertion. So the direct implication is that all theodicies are false or inadequate. So In other words, we don't really have a morally sufficient reason why God would permit evil. Now, if you read the text, Fatuma gives a kind of brief nod, the briefest of nods, towards Leibniz's best of all possible worlds theodicy. But then he quickly says, Voltaire's Candide knocks it down, right? So he doesn't engage with any other theodicies. I mean, none. There's no citation of the literature. And of course, the question of theodicy goes back 2,500 years or more. There's no hint of any justification at all for or engagement with the literature at all on this. It's just a brute assertion. It also looks like he has a hidden assumption. Here's the key premise, as we've noted. We cannot rationalize why a good God would allow X, these selfish behaviors. So that is, we can't think of a good reason. And he seems to conclude from that, so there is no reason. We can't think of a reason, so there is no reason. Now this, again, is crucial, right? Because on Fatuma's view, if a good God exists, we would not expect selfish behaviors. But if evolution is true, we would expect selfish behaviors. The fact that we can't think of a reason means these selfish behaviors are much more compatible with an evolutionary view. Again, it's part of his positive argument for evolutionary theory. Of course, there's a hidden assumption here, right? If God were to have a reason, a morally sufficient reason, we would know it, right? If you move from we can't think of a reason to there is none, the assumption is, well, if there was one around, there it is. It's right there, right? So a crucial assumption, if God were to have a reason, we would know it. There is, for this crucial assumption, again, there's no justification given, right? Apparently, on Fatuma's view, he's an atheist. We can plumb the mind of God and know exhaustively what any reasons are there. So just to be clear here, I'm not arguing that that Fatuma's conclusion is wrong. I'm not saying that there is an adequate theodicy, right? I'm only arguing that he's making crucial theology-laden assumptions about what humans can know about God and so on, about whether theodicies fail and so on, with no justification, no engagement with the literature at all. All right, stepping back, what can we conclude? First, a number of textbooks rely on theology-laden claims as part of their positive case for evolution. Lots of examples of this. Secondly, these claims are foreign to creationism and ID. I mean foreign in the sense they're not entailed by either view, nor are they made probable, right? Except for indeterminate God theology, right? God is free to do X. That's certainly compatible with a young earth view, but of course, the argument doesn't go anywhere. Three, textbooks offer no citation, justification, evidence, or arguments for these claims. They're just brute assertions. They look to be the author's own subjective preferences about what God would do were God to exist. If you want a sort of a point three and a half here, I would say upon examination, a number of these claims arguably are somewhat dubious too, right? But that would be sort of another point to develop. And then fourth, quite a number of textbooks undermine the scientific legitimacy of these same claims. So a fair number, not all, but a fair number of textbooks, if you look not at the chapter, The Evidence for Evolution, that's what Nick and I mainly focus on. If you look at the first chapter, it usually lays out what science is, what the standard scientific methodology or methodologies are, and so on. And often in that first chapter, many textbooks will adopt something like Stephen Jay Gould's Noma or complementarity or methodological naturalism, right? So that theological propositions are not proper, they're not at home, they're not allowed in scientific discourse and research, including scientific argumentation, confirmation, and so on, right? Early chapters, theology is excluded. Later chapters, when it's handy to have it around, it's not excluded, it's inserted, which means that these textbooks, on their own terms, are just an incoherent mess. Bad news. Okay, so here's my humble recommendation. Biology professors and teachers ought to consider exposing students to different arguments for evolutionary theory. I think that will help biological education. Thanks.
Textbooks are setting up, perpetuating this dichotomy ultimately. Are any of the 30 make some sort of statement of a theistic evolutionary possibility, giving that option for some who are religious?
I wouldn't say, so there's two parts to comment on. I wouldn't say they're setting up a dichotomy. Well, in a sense, you're right. They are, a lot of them do set up something of a dichotomy where they will repeatedly focus on either 19th century special creation or a kind of young earth view, right? And sometimes they conflate the two. But if you look at, if you look deeper at the theology that's in play, it's not really a dichotomy between those two. The dichotomy, if we want to use that language, is between evolutionary theory on the one hand and this whole series of theology-laden claims that are foreign to special creation or to young earth creationism or to ID. So I think that's really what's going on, although the packaging is just as you say. And in terms of theistic evolution, sometimes when you look at the early chapters, they'll give a nod, like religious people, many religious organizations and churches find evolutionary theory perfectly compatible with their religious beliefs, although science can't decide one way or the other about certain religious beliefs. You find that in a fair number.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
These textbooks, do any of them consult with, religious authorities on in their framing of any of them? I mean, it sounds like they maybe don't, or at least it sounds like mainly they're just sort of out of touch with what the Christian community or other religious groups might be thinking. Do you know anything about process that they go through?
That's a great question, and I don't know. The textbooks we look at are mainstream ones, Campbell Biology, 9th and 10th editions, Fatuma's text. We look at a whole range. Some are less well-known, but some are the standard edition that thousands upon thousands. So they would go through the usual peer review channels, and I think part of the, really part of the challenge or part of the problem is, I think a lot of these authors get their view of their rival of creationism from the origin of species or something downstream from the origin. And of course, in the origin, Darwin doesn't engage the full range of creationist view, like Agassiz's view or Owen's view, and he doesn't even characterize special creation correctly, as Paley would, right? So I think, in my view, the caricatures begin early, and there's a sort of descent with very little modification, I think, into the present day. What happens?
Along that line that you looked, additional kind of theological, philosophical comments just being thrown in, likewise unjustified, or I think it was an old edition of Evolution that had the statement that evolution shows that we are masters of our own fate. I like to use that as a quote to my students, then suggest that the dinosaurs are a great example of that.
That's good.
Obviously, it's somebody's philosophical statement just thrown in there without even thinking whether it actually is.
Yeah, that's, you're referring to an earlier edition of Fatuma's text?
That's where I saw that picture.
He actually also says, I find this very interesting, he asserts that God cannot be known apart from examining nature. So I'm trained in philosophy of religion. That just blows my mind that you would say that. Is there any justification, citation of the literature? None. Right? But then, of course, if you keep reading literally on the same page, he's making divine counterfactuals. Were God to exist, God would have done X, Y, and Z. Because it's a counterfactual, you can look at nature all day long and you'll never justify that claim. It's all on the same page. Yeah, I get excited about it. Alarmed, maybe. Yeah. You good?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So my own experience of teaching freshmen makes me suspect that some of these authors may be framing this as a response to things they've encountered in their classrooms repeatedly. Do you have any feeling for that, the way they've been questioned or the conversations they've had or the discussions or the problems that students have brought to them, that sort of thing?
I think that's fair. I think in addition to, as it were, pulling from Darwin's characterization of special creation, I mean, you can't really be in the United States today, particularly if you're presumably a biology professor writing textbooks, without noticing public opinion polls about young earth creationism, the dichotomy that Dennis was talking about. So I imagine there's definitely some of that influence. How much, we don't know. But even deeper than that, right? Deeper than that, the claims they're attributing to their opponents are not really their claims, right?
Anybody else? All right, thank
okay.
you very much.
All right, thanks.
So you're going to use.